And we're back. Greetings, fellow mystic mavericks, unconventional utopians, and curious contemplators. Welcome back to the magical, mystical, non-dual world of Sri Nisargadatta's I Am That. The book, as you may know, stems from a series of spontaneous interactions with seekers who came to visit this man we now call Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj. Seekers who were invited, I guess, to participate in his informal satsangs. Satsang, a Sanskrit term meaning associations with the wise. These were, by all accounts, quite laid back and intimate affairs, a bit like a conversation podcast, come to think of it, held in Nisargadatta's humble abode midst the bustling lanes of Kedwadi in Bombay, or as we now call it, Mumbai. Nisargadatta Maharaj, despite his growing recognition at the time, this was the 1960s, 1970s, as a spiritual teacher, maintained a very simple lifestyle, living in a small room that was part of a tenement. His living space, in which the satsangs were given, also doubled as a shop where he sold bidis to support himself and his family. People from various walks of life, including both Indians and foreigners, scholars, seekers, and those just simply curious about the nature of existence, so I guess all of us really, would attend these satsangs, drawn by Maharaj's reputation as a realized master in the Advaita Vedanta tradition. Everyone eager to hear his teachings and pose questions about spirituality, enlightenment, and the practicalities of living in the world whilst striving for spiritual understanding, which again, maybe like many of us, right? And as far as we know, the conversational evenings usually kicked off with Maharaj chilling on a little raised seat or platform with folks gathered round on the floor, setting the scene for some very real and unfiltered talk. You know, it was all about everyone being on the same level, literally and figuratively, ready to dive into the big questions. The format of the meeting was, as you can hear, open, interactive. Attendees were encouraged to ask questions directly to Maharaj, leading to spontaneous, dynamic exchanges. Who knows how many other similar satsangs were occurring in Bombay at the time, of which we have no knowledge now, and even if we could travel back in time, most of us would not be able to follow these dialogues as they were all in Marathi, a language which I'm told is incredibly rich in nuance and depth, and still spoken in India today by over 80 million people. So, perhaps even more incredible that sitting in this setting was this other guy called Maurice Friedman, who seems to have been pretty instrumental in bringing these dialogues to us, thanks to his decision to record, curate, as well as transcribe and translate the text we have in our hands today. Friedman is the second fascinating figure, I think, in this magical book, a kind of Ananda to Maharaj's Buddha, a Polish Jew deeply involved in the Indian independence movement and an ardent disciple of spiritual teachings. Friedman was so profoundly impacted by Nisargadatta's teachings that he felt called, I guess, to compile the dialogues into a book so as to make his guru's words and ideas accessible to a wider audience. And this also feels very much in keeping for how these recordings came about. Just like you, I imagine, dear listener of this podcast, I too, at some point, fell in love with these dialogues and wanted to record them, mainly, if I can remember, really just to have the pleasure of saying the words out loud and having the space to hear the dialogues spoken as they were originally intended to be heard. After doing this by myself for a while, which is kind of tricky, as a dialogue sort of requires two voices, Vimla kindly agreed to help me read them, and we did a whole bunch of episodes together. But then, as you can also see, I sort of ran out of steam on the project. An important relationship ended. I became, I suppose, a little bit metaphysically and otherwise untethered, and although wanting to finish the project, it just sort of ground to a halt. Enter Mark, who dropped me a line to ask if the readings were going to be continued, and then kindly offered to help me do so, which is what led to us speaking last week, me in my flat in London and him in his shared house in Philadelphia. And it was such fun. The joy of such a conversation is that even after talking for 2 hours, I still have no idea what Mark does in terms of work, livelihood. I don't know if he's married. I don't know if he's partnered. I'm sure I'll find out in time. But how magical, really, to be able to sit down with someone and start talking to them about those things that agitate or nourish our souls, to go really deep and explore without having to do any of the small talk. Just bliss, absolute bliss. In my mind, Mark and I weren't on Google Meet, weren't on screens. No, we'd gone back in time. This was 1969 in Khetwadi, Mumbai, the two of us having, you know, pitched up, as I'm sure we might have done if we'd been in town, at one of Nisargadatta's satsangs. And then after witnessing this incredibly rich discussion between Maharaj and those in attendance, perhaps finding ourselves, as we did on that Thursday evening, just standing in the street outside the flat, which would tomorrow become a tiny shop, scratching our heads and brimming with all sorts of questions and notions about what we'd just witnessed. So join us in that spirit as we talk about some of the things that confused us and enlightened us about these words, the words of this chapter, chapter 54, in the spirit and the poetry, really, of Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj.
Oh, babe, I'm getting serious, getting serious. You know I'm getting serious, getting serious.
But first off, we have to... we have to flip a coin to see who's going to read what.
Do you want to call it? Yeah? Okay, ready? Should I all flip?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Tails?
You got it.
Am I Maharaj?
You're Maharaj.
Oh dear. This is where I confess that I only read half of it before we started, because I had a client.
Oh, okay.
And I was almost hoping you would be Maharaj, so that I could then just sit and kind of have a bit of more time to think about it. But that's cool.
It's up to you. Yeah. I mean, I could be. It's up to you. Yeah.
No. The coin has decided. Okay. No, this is not.
Okay.
You don't fight the coin. You don't fight the universe, right?
Okay. Perfect. Very, very true. Very true. All right. Ready when you are.
Babe, I'm getting serious, getting serious. You know I'm getting serious, getting serious. Babe, you're superhuman.
You and me and you.
So, we are discussing one day the person, the witness, the absolute. As far as I can remember, you said the absolute alone is real, and the witness is absolute only at a given point of space and time. The person is the organism, gross and subtle, illumined by the presence of the witness. I do not seem to grasp the matter clearly. Could we discuss it again? You also use the terms Mahagadash, Chikakash, and Paramakash. How are they related to person, witness, and the absolute?
Mahadakash is nature, the ocean of existences, the physical space with all that can be contacted through the senses. Chidakash is the expanse of awareness, the mental space of time, perception, and cognition. Paramakash is the timeless and spaceless reality, mindless, undifferentiated, the infinite potentiality, the source and origin, the substance and the essence, both matter and consciousness, yet beyond both. It cannot be perceived, but can be experienced as ever witnessing. The witness perceiving the perceiver, the origin and the end of all manifestation. the root of time and space, the prime cause in every chain of causation.
What is the difference between vyakta and avyakta?
There is no difference. It's like light and daylight. The universe is full of light, which you do not see, but the same light you see as daylight. And what the daylight reveals is the vyakti. The person is always the object. The witness is the subject, and their relation of mutual dependence is the reflection of their absolute identity. You imagine that they are distinct and separate states. They are not. They are the same consciousness at rest and in movement, each state conscious of the other. In chit, man knows God, and God knows man. In chit, the man shapes the world, and the world shapes man. Chit is the link, the bridge between extremes, the balancing and uniting factor in every experience. The totality of the perceived is what you call matter. The totality of all perceivers is what you call the universal mind. The identity of the two, manifesting itself as perceptibility and perceiving, harmony and intelligence, loveliness and loving, reasserts itself eternally.
The three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, are they only in matter or also in the mind?
In both, of course, because the two are not separate. It is only the absolute that is beyond gunas. In fact, these are but points of view, ways of looking. They exist only in the mind. Beyond the mind, all distinctions cease.
Is the universe a product of the senses?
Just as you recreate your world on waking up, so is the universe unrolled. The mind, with its five organs of perception, five organs of action, and five vehicles of consciousness, appears as memory, as thought, as reason, and as selfhood.
The sciences have made much progress. We know the body and the mind much better than our ancestors. Your traditional way of describing and analyzing mind and matter is no longer valid.
But where are your scientists with their sciences? Are they not again images in your own mind?
Here lies the basic difference. To me, they are not my own projections. They were before I was born and shall be there when I'm dead.
Of course. Once you accept time and space as real, you will consider yourself minute and short-lived. But are they real? Do they depend on you, or you on them? As body, you are in space. As mind, you are in time. But are you mere body with a mind? Mere body with a mind in it. Have you ever investigated?
I had neither the motive or the method.
I'm suggesting both. But the actual work of insight and detachment is yours.
The only motive I can perceive is my own causeless and timeless happiness. And what is the method?
The only motive you can perceive is your own causeless and timeless happiness. Happiness is incidental. The true and effective motive is love. You see, people suffer, and you seek the best way of helping them. The answer is obvious. First, put yourself beyond the need of help. Be sure your attitude is of pure goodwill, free of expectation of any kind. Those who seek mere happiness may end up in sublime indifference, while love will never rest. As to the method, there is only one. You must come to know yourself, both what you appear to be and what you are. Clarity and charity sound, it's also, they rhyme, which is pretty cool. Clarity and charity go together. Each needs and strengthens the other.
Okay. Compassion implies the difference of an objective world full of avoidable sorrow.
The world is not objective. And the sorrow of it is not avoidable. Compassion is but another word for the refusal to suffer for imaginary reasons.
If the reasons are imaginary, why should the suffering be inevitable?
It is always the false that makes you suffer, the false desires and fears, the false values and ideas, the false relationships between people. Abandon the false, and you are free of pain. Truth makes happy. Truth liberates.
The truth is that I am a mind imprisoned in a body, and this is a very unhappy truth.
You are neither the body nor in the body. There is no such thing as body. You have grievously misunderstood yourself. To understand rightly, investigate.
But I was born as a body, in a body, and shall die with the body, as a body.
This is your misconception. Inquire, investigate, doubt yourself and others. To find truth, you must not cling to your convictions. If you are sure of the immediate, you will never reach the ultimate. Your idea that you were born and that you will die is absurd. Both logic and experience contradicted.
All right. I shall not insist that I am a body. You have a point there. But here and now, as I talk to you, I am in my body, obviously. The body may not be me, but it is mine.
The entire universe, we might say, contributes incessantly to your existence. Hence, the entire universe is your body. In that sense, I agree.
Well, my body influences me deeply. In more than one way, my body is my destiny. My character, my moods, the nature of my reactions, my desires and fears, inborn and acquired, they are all based on the body. A little alcohol, some drug or another, and all changes. Until the drug wears off, I become another man.
All this happens because you think yourself to be the body. Realize your real self, and even drugs will have no power over you.
You smoke, though.
I love this part. Sorry, it's hard to read this part without laughing. My body kept a few habits, which may as well continue till it dies. There is no harm in them.
You eat meat too, yeah?
I was born among meat-eating people, and my children are eating meat. I eat very little and make no fuss.
Meat-eating implies killing.
Obviously, I make no claims of consistency. You think absolute consistency is possible? Prove it by example. Don't preach what you don't practice. Coming back to the idea of having been born. You lot are stuck with what your parents told you. All about conception, pregnancy, birth, infant, child, youngster, teenager, and so on. Now, divest yourself of the idea that you are the body. It is also an idea, no doubt, treated like something to be abandoned when its work is done. The idea that I am not the body gives reality to the body, when in fact there is no such thing as body. It is but a state of mind. You can have as many bodies and as diverse as you like. Just remember steadily what you want and reject the incompatibles.
Ooh. Whoa. As many bodies as I want. Just reject the incompatibilities.
There you go.
That's all you gotta do is reject them. Okay. I am like a box within a box within a box. The outer box acting as the body and the one next to it as the indwelling soul. Abstract the outer box and the next becomes the body and the next one and the one next to it the soul. It is an infinite series, an endless opening of boxes. Is the last one the ultimate soul?
If you have a body, you must have a soul. Here your simile of a nest of boxes applies. But here and now, through all your bodies and souls, shines awareness, the pure light of chit. Hold on to it, unswervingly. Without awareness, the body would not last a second. There is in the body a currency of energy, affection, intelligence, which guides, maintains, energizes the body. Discover that current and stay with it. Of course, all of these are just manners of speaking. Words are as much a barrier as a bridge. Find the spark of life that weaves the tissues of your body. And be with it. This is the only reality the body has.
Whew. Okay. What happens to that spark of life after death?
It is beyond time. Birth and death are but points in time. Life weaves eternally, its many webs. The weaving is in time, but life itself is timeless. Whatever name and shape you give to its expression, it is like the ocean, ever changing.
Whoa, never changing. Like the ocean. Okay. All you say sounds beautifully convincing. Yet my feeling of being just a person in a world strange and alien, often inimical and dangerous, does not cease. Being a person, limited in space and time, how can I possibly realize myself as the opposite, a depersonalized, universalized awareness of nothing in particular?
You assert yourself to be what you are not, and deny yourself to be what you are. You omit the element of pure cognition, of awareness free from all personal distortions. Unless you admit the reality of chit, you will never know yourself.
Ooh, reality of chit. What am I to do? I do not see myself as you see me. Maybe you are right and I am wrong, but how can I cease to be what I feel I am?
A prince who believes himself to be a beggar can be convinced conclusively in one way only. He must behave as a prince and see what happens. Behave as if what I say is true and judge by what actually happens. All I ask is the little faith needed for making the first step. With experience will come confidence, and you will not need me anymore. I know what you are, and I am telling you. Trust me. For a while.
To be here and now, I need my body and its senses. To understand, I need a mind.
The body and the mind are only symptoms of ignorance, of misapprehension. Behave as if you were pure awareness, bodiless and mindless, spaceless and timeless, beyond where, beyond when, beyond how. Dwell on this. Think of this. Learn to accept its reality. Don't oppose it and deny it all the time. Keep an open mind, at least. Yoga is bending the outer to the inner. Make your mind and body express the real, which is all and beyond all. Which is all and beyond all. That is the real. It is all and beyond all. By doing, you succeed, not by arguing.
Kindly allow me to come back to my first question. How does the error of being a person originate?
Okay, maybe like this. The absolute precedes time, right? Absolute precedes time. So you have the absolute preceding time. Awareness comes first, bundle of memories, mental habits, attracts attention. Awareness gets focalized, and a person suddenly appears. Remove the light of awareness, go to sleep or swoon away, and the person disappears. The person, vyakti, flickers off, on, off, on. Awareness, vyakta, contains space and time, all space and time. But the absolute is.
Oof.
There, yes. You go. Slam dunk. Yeah.
Wow, that last one is just, oh my god, that's one you could just keep hitting the back 15-30 seconds on and just five times in a row. That's the man, and you nailed it with the intonation too. Wow,
you're right. And I guess if we don't know if further conversation occurred, you know, maybe he said, and that's it for today, guys, see you next week. Okay, so let's imagine we're ejected out onto the streets, scratching our heads. We don't actually have, we don't have the transcript. But we probably do remember the final words, you know. And maybe that's a good place to start. Because I guess, for me, if I can kind of launch into my perplexity, right? Because I have a lot of perplexity coming back to Maharaj. And I guess my perplexity is maybe, but it's also a sort of like, yeah, maybe that could work. It's that behave as if. Behave as if, okay? So he's basically saying to you, listen, don't, you know, this is the way to do it, right? I mean, if he's giving you a practice, this is the practice. Behave as if you were pure awareness, you're bodiless, you're mindless, you're spaceless, you're timeless, you're beyond the where, the when, the how, right? Okay. Now, when you're doing that, Yeah, what's that like? There you go. Now, how do you do that? How do you behave as if you are pure awareness, bodiless, mindless, blah, 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 when I don't know about you, but I haven't yet crossed over into actually, you know, thinking that this thing here, this lump of meat that I'm currently punching, is not here. It seems to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of it's one of those things, you know, we get like we see that that physical thing that seems to be happening isn't the actual truth when we see like more clearly through spiritual texts like what we just read. Like there's a deeper, realer truth that is there, and then that is an illusory truth. So if we just act as if, but then we just forget that, you know, as the human minds naturally do. So like, if we act as if it's true, it's just a way to keep recalling it being that. And then as long as you can just sort of see what would happen if you act in that way, you're attempting to stay present to the case or the fact or the awareness that we are the awareness, and that since that staying present to that is the thing that we're supposed to be doing, that it's just a pointer to keep doing that, to act as if we're just staying present to that as much as we can and always can.
But my other perplexity is around the absolute thing, right? Because I get the person, I get the witness, but who's to say that the absolute is not just an idea in the mind of the witness or the person, right? I mean, this is where I struggle. It seems that sort of seems like a leap of faith in a way.
Yeah, definitely. I think that like the, so, you know, when I like, you know, so you can imagine maybe anything you want and picture anything you want in your mind. I don't think our minds can capture any kind of necessarily absolute reality, but they can picture stuff really well and imagine things really well. So when we're doing that, I think what they're pointing to is when you imagine in that way that it is the absolute, that imagining perspective has the best results for a human who wants to transcend their experience of being an ego to being the witnessing consciousness experience, which is a much more enjoyable experience. And having the perspective of the absolute, I think, kind of supercharges that in the same way that God does in religion in general. Like, it's just a powerful, and there's some truth to it, but it's not factual. It's like more of a, you know, experience.
I like that, So the absolute, at some level, it's okay if we hold it in mind as a story, but for it to be, for everything else to kind of slot in, is it like there has to be that absolute, there has to be this kind of, you know, it's very Platonic in a sense, it's the idea of logos, you know, it's the idea of like, there is a realm in which there is this kind of absolute perfect meaning, beyond words, beyond everything. But that's also just the Platonic idea, right? But again, for us to actually construct a meaningful life, or whatever the case may be, is it a case that we need that part of the engine, even if it's held there just by faith? I don't know. What does the absolute suggest to you? What does it even mean?
So, like, as I'm sitting here, I'm looking at the, like, translucent face of this crystal Buddha in my office and, like, feeling into the consciousness, the chit experience, and then, like, in the reflections of the crystal Buddha, as I maintain the awareness thing, it starts to expand kind of in subtlety and in, like, a field of beingness. It starts to expand, and it seems like it's, like, an infinite thing that's happening, you know, it like kind of so that is spaciousness in that's in the subtlety or in like the moment that, I think, is sort of a thing that they're pointing to as this, like, it's beyond space and time. Like, there's not, like, the space and time is a mind thing, and it's not like it's a fact. It's a thing that it's the way we perceive it.
Of course, this is the question of every seeker, right? What is the absolute, and how to know it, and how to know it at a, yeah, as you say, at an experiential level, right?
Probably just, I mean, there, these things, you know, you can do drugs, or, you know, if you want to do it without drugs, then you do it, you know, just like this constant inquiry, or you can do like a lot of meditation, of course, but the constant inquiry, you know, where you're just all the, as you know, the more you ask, like, who am I, or I, or remind yourself, I am that, I'm the witnessing consciousness, I am, and every time the ego says a bunch of stuff, and it draws the veil over your perceptual reality with, like, the thought stuff, then you just say, okay, I am the perceiving reality right now, and the thoughts are, and then, oh shit, the thoughts are made up. And then the more you do that, you can do it in, like, long meditation things, or just through, you know, then I think that seems to be the main way.
And so what does that boil down to you, for you as a kind of a practice? Is it just really just staying with this curiosity towards your experience in the moment, essentially?
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, so spiritual study, I'm just like, you know, reading or listening to things that are basically all the Advaita stuff, like reminding you that you're the witnessing consciousness. Who am I? Witnessing consciousness. Who am I? Witnessing consciousness. You know, just so, and then just trying to do that without efforting too much, if possible. Just trying to let go of the efforting, but still every time thinking and identification happens, remembering, oh, who is that? And it's like, oh me? Oh, who am I? Oh, shit, I'm sitting here. Or, okay, I guess it's all made up. And then, you know, doing that just all day, anytime that comes up, until at some point, when I just, like, kind of just can't do that anymore, I try to do this for as long as possible. Then when I just eventually stop, and then hopefully it just becomes subconsciously registered. And if that happens, which often can after, like, some months or whatever of just trying to do that as much as possible, then it's in this, because it's a subconscious thing that, like, this, it's like, if that's happening in the subconscious, it's that remembering, oh, the thoughts are made up, oh, this thought's made up, every thought's made up, it's, you're actually just here, then you just create, it just creates, like, that psychic space, like the space that you can witness and choose thoughts, or choose to pay attention to something else, your body, your foot, a different thought, make up a thought. It just creates this amazing spaciousness, I think, that they're pointing to as not being identified with the body, but being identified as the witnessing consciousness.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think it needs that kind of, like, a lens. It needs to be, it would almost be like somebody had to carry, right, because we're sort of blind, so you would have like a lens that brings that awareness back to you, right? And so you could, and almost everything we see, hear, think, you know, all of that perceptual stuff, you would need to sort of train yourself, or have a period where, and I suppose that is what kind of that continual inquiry needs, of just bringing that very simple lens in front and just sort of showing you the trick, and showing you that, you know, that, oh, you know, don't get to, yeah, it's a trick, da, 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 and doing it again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's the tricky part, isn't it? Because what is it, again, kind of thinking, what is it in that spark? You know, he talks about the life spark. What is it about a particular spark that might drive, let's say, you to do that in a consistent and conscientious way for periods of time, and might drive someone else who's listened to this and goes, yeah, I think that would be really, really clarifying for me to do, and yet can't bring themselves, that's an interesting expression, can't bring themselves to doing it, right? And I would say that counts for me most of the time. I can't bring myself, right, sometimes to do certain things they would be really great. So what is it, what is it that, again, we're back to this question, what is it that brings you to this, to doing it?
Yeah, I feel like probably, like, you are doing it, though. I mean, we are, you're doing it now. So, like, I feel like probably the, I don't know how much say we have in that. It might be kind of a grace thing, or, you know, and it's not like, I think there's, like, in infinite lifetimes, and time isn't even sequential, so it's not even, I don't know if there's too much you can do. So when you're, so if you're a person, then you think you're doing stuff, then you're like, okay, I want to do this thing, but I can't do it. And it's like, okay, well, I'm not sure if it even works that way. To bring anything to yourself, you know, you just sort of focus on it, talk to people about it, and, you know, look for what's real for you about it, and, like, kind of tap into the matrix, or tap into the field, or into the, you know, thing going on. And it might be the experience only that you're changing.